Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the richest nation in the world, right after this. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, great and small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, great and small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, and a perfect and a just measure shall you have, that your days may be lengthened in the land." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." Well, in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills, and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we are the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that we teach in our Mosaic Law School, and we conduct that school here twice a year at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home. georgegordon.org. The richest nation in the world. Well, what country is that? Right now, as I speak, the world is in a financial crisis. I don't think we would call Greece the richest nation in the world. Generally speaking, that honor goes to the United States of America. And during the 2008 election, the Lehr NewsHour was interviewing people as to their preferences for president, and for that matter, they wanted to know what some of the issues were that these people, the potential voters of 2008, were interested in. And one night in Denver, Colorado, they were interviewing probably 10, 12 people, and there was one young woman there, pretty young girl, probably in her early 20s, and she was very interested in the Obama health care plan. She should be very happy now that it's been enacted. She was not only in favor of it, she made this comment. She said that health care is a right. Health care is a right of all Americans. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, now I wonder where that young woman got the idea that health care was a right and that every American had a right to this health care. Evidently, she learned that in the public education system. She didn't learn it from our Constitution. She didn't learn it from our founding fathers. She had to have learned that from some socialist, some communist, someplace that instilled in her mind that from each according to his ability and to each according to his need was a right of all Americans. Because if every American has a right to health care, well then, shouldn't every American have a right to a house or a home or to an automobile or to food, clothing, and shelter? And if that's the case, who's going to pay for it and who determines what quality or the amount that these people are going to receive? Well, leaving that aside, let's start delving into this thing called the richest nation in the world. If you lived in the richest nation in the world, how would you know that? Would it be Russia, Germany, France, Canada, Australia, Indonesia, Brazil? You know, oftentimes people will say, oh no, you couldn't do it in Brazil. They've got too much poverty there. Has anybody ever thought to ask, well, what is poverty? What is wealth? Who makes that determination? Where is that definition written in the dictionary or in the encyclopedia? How would we know if a person was in poverty or a person was rich? Think about that for a minute. You know, here in America, you got people who are in debt, whose houses are being foreclosed on and they're being taken away from them. These are people that make $100 a day or more, and they're unable to make their payments. They're unable to keep their homes, they're unable to keep their houses. Now, if we were to measure that $100 a day against some average Joe six-pack, let's say, working in Niger or Nigeria or Gabon in Africa, where the average daily wage is $2 a day, or against Mexico, where the average wage is $9 a day. You know, you'd have to say that American is just filthy rich. Why, my God, he's making $100 a day. And if I said, we got a guy over here making $100 a day, I think most Americans would say, well, that poor guy would qualify for food stamps. Wouldn't he? Let's think about it for a minute. If you're working 5 days a week, times 50 weeks a year, that's 250 days, times $100 is $25,000 a year. And I think the poverty line in the United States is around 21 or 22,000. They call you living in poverty if you're making below 20,000 a year here in this country. Why, if you were making $20,000 a year, almost any place else in the world, they'd call you rich. So it dawned on me, I said, you know, this thing of wealth or riches is a subjective type measurement. Compared to what? You know, if you compared me to Bill Gates, I'm poverty stricken. Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, has $37 billion. And I don't have $37 billion. Let's assume for the sake of our discussion that I had $1 million. Some people would say, well, that guy Gordon's rich. He's got $1 million. I can remember when $1 million was a lot of money. But today, $1 million isn't all that much. You've got people in this country who are buying houses for $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, and they're just middle-class working people. I didn't say they owned the houses. I just said that they're making payments on it, and they hope someday when they get all the payments done that they'll own the house. But, you know, when you start talking about the richest nation in the world, I knew a guy one time in Salt Lake City, and I thought he was a pretty wealthy and successful real estate broker. He was in the brokerage business, had a number of salesmen working with him. And when the economic bubble popped about 1980, 81, 82, remember that real estate bubble that popped at about the time Ronald Reagan was elected to office back in 1980? This guy had three Rolls Royces. Now, back in the 70s, these Rolls were selling for $105,000 apiece. And I thought, wow, here's a guy with three Rolls Royces, a real estate brokerage business. I don't know how many salesmen he had working for him, you know. It may have been five, may have been 50. I couldn't tell you, but he had some. That's pretty successful, I'd say. Well, about 1981 or two, after this real estate bubble popped, this guy lost all three of his Rolls Royces, and he lost his own home. He's still a real estate broker, but he couldn't make his payments. He was in debt farther than his assets. And so as the thing unwound and he had to pay off, you know, he had to sell his assets, and pretty soon he didn't have anything left. Taught me a lesson. I said, you know, just because a guy is driving a Porsche or driving a fancy car doesn't mean he's got any money. And if a guy had a lot of money, would that necessarily make him rich? I've known people that had a lot of money. And most people, when you ask them, well, how much money do you have? One time there was a guy named Burkett. And he worked at the Humboldt Creamery. And at the time, he was buying stock. And this is about 1960, 61, 62, 63, long in there. And we called him Pluto. And Pluto probably had $150,000 worth of stock. And he was really interested in the stock market. And he was always talking about stocks. And he took his paychecks and he kept investing it in stocks. And at that time, stocks kept going up and up and up. And so he kept making more and more and more. And so as time progressed along, you know, he made more and more in the stock market. Well, let me tell you a little story here. I don't know how much Pluto invested in the stock market, but I know it was more than $10,000. Because he had $150,000 in value at that time, and he'd been investing his paycheck, you know, every week. He's a single kid living at home with mom and dad, so he had all of his disposable income pretty much available to him. But I worked out the numbers to this some years back, so get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls, and let me show you a little something here about wealth. If in 1960 you had $10,000 in cash and you went out and you bought the Dow Jones Industrial Average, those are the blue chip stocks. Those are the best stocks that money can buy. That's General Motors and General Electric and companies, you know, that have been around for a long time, make a lot of money. If you had invested at that time $10,000 in 1960 in blue chip stocks, in the year 2000, 40 years later, if you sold those stocks, you would have made 5% per year compounded annually for 40 years. And it totals 73,000 and some change. If you do the arithmetic on that, $70,000 plus and some change. Now, that's a pretty darn good return. And I have to admit, that's pretty darn good. You know, if you had $10,000 invested, and then you got to the end of some time over here, and you had seven times more than you started with, you know, that's pretty darn good. And I'm sure that that's what Pluto had in mind, and I'm sure that that's what he accomplished in the end. But at the very same time that this was going on, there was inflation in the land, and inflation between 1960 and 2000 averaged 4.3%. Or 4.7. Now I kind of forget which one it was, 4.3 or 4.7. But you know, let's just pick 4.3. Now that means that your net profit was 0.7% per year compounded for 40 years. Now you got to pay your capital gain tax, and the capital gain tax isn't paid on the 0.7% net, it's paid on the 5% gross. That's what you got paid, 5% interest compounded over that period of time. And then you don't get a deduction for the 4.7 or 4.3%. So in the final analysis, take 28% of your $70,000, and then you'll end up with about 50. And then when you get through, you have a net loss of $3,800 of purchasing power out of your $10,000. Or put another way, you could have bought 10,000 loaves of hillbilly bread on January 1st, 1960. Then after you cashed out on January 1st, 2000, after having made out all your tax returns for 40 years and paid all your capital gain taxes on all of your profits, you could take the proceeds down and buy hillbilly bread and you'd get 6,200 loaves. You have a net loss of 3,800 loaves of purchasing power. Now, it's called the hidden tax, is what that is. That's a hidden tax. It's inflation. We all pay it, whether we like it or not. And that hidden tax is very beneficial to corporate America, politicians, bankers, and insurance companies. They all profit handsomely off of that inflation. Now, the rest of us not only don't profit, we have to pay for that. Every dollar that's transferred to the bank comes out of your pocket. Now, this young woman says, we live in America, the home of the free, the land of the brave, the richest nation in the world, where every American is entitled to health care insurance. And I wanted to ask the question, is America the richest nation in the world? Has it ever been the richest nation in the world? Well, yeah, there was a time here in America, if we were to apply some objective standards to wealth, when you could say that America, the nation, and America, the people that lived therein, were in fact the wealthiest people, the people who had the most money, best health. Well, put another way, they had no national debt. They had a positive balance of payments every year. They had an agricultural surplus. The money that they used had a real value, 100% of its face value. Their citizens were healthy with no doctors and no hospitals. They produced more than they consumed. They had a budget surplus every year, both nationally and in their state and local governments and in their personal budgets. They had zero inflation. In fact, in most years, they had deflation. They owned their homes free and clear. And the citizens who pay cash for everything, and they didn't deal in credit, most of those people could live at least 1 year without any income, and many of them could live as much as 3 years without any income. They were self-sufficient. The nation had nearly zero crime. They had few, if any, birth defects. They lent around the world, but they did not borrow. And they had no banks. And they had no insurance companies. And they had no stock or bond markets. They didn't have any droughts. They had rain in due season. They had no public schools. They had limited government. And they practiced private property. So I sat down and I wrote up those 22 elements to wealth. 22 elements that constitute wealth. Now let me take a look at one here. They would have no national debt. Now the national debt of the United States of America today is $14 trillion. Well, it's not quite that. That's what the limit is set at. We're going to hit that in a year or so. And then we'll have to raise it to 16 and then to 18 and then 20. So I'm just going to round it off. It's at $14 trillion. Now, in 1836, the national debt was at zero. A fellow by the name of Andrew Jackson decided that we should pay it off. And so in that period of time between the Revolutionary War and 1836, he got the national debt paid off. Now, in 1930, I think our national debt was around $2 billion. We still had some residue left over from World War I. Wasn't much, but there was some. And that $2 billion has now grown to, I think it's right at $14 trillion. Now, let me ask you this question. If a nation had zero national debt, would it be a wealthier nation than a nation who had some or a lot of national debt? In my estimation, the country that had zero national debt, or the family that had zero debt, or the individual who owed no one anything. There's a scripture in the Bible, in Romans 13:8, that says, "Owe no man anything." That's a wild new thought. Have you ever thought about a point in time in your life when you would not owe anybody anything? Would you be wealthier if you didn't owe anybody anything than if you owed the bank $30,000 on your house? Would you be wealthier if you were debt-free, free and clear, than if you had a $5,000 debt to pay on your car, or a $500 or $5,000 or $50,000 debt on your credit cards? In short, would a person who is debt-free be wealthier than a person who had some or a lot of debt? So I think that we could all of us agree that the person who has debt would be poorer, have less wealth than the guy who had none. Now, I know somebody's going to say, well, but what about the guy that borrowed $1 million and bought a lot of real estate, and he's making a lot of income, and he has a $500,000 worth of debt, but he's got $300,000 worth of assets, and he's driving a Rolls Royce. Now, I told you about the fellow, the real estate broker, with three Rolls Royces. Now, the lesson that I took from that was is that he didn't own those three Rolls Royces. He was making payments on them. It looked good, nice-looking cars. But when an economic bubble broke, he lost it all. Well, now, that being the case, would we say the guy was wealthy? I mean, you know, there was a time when he had a pretty healthy balance sheet, but then he didn't own that stuff free and clear, and then when he couldn't make the payments, he lost it. Now, there's a lot of ne'er-do-wells. This is what they used to call them when I was a kid. There was a fella, and then he would be driving a new car, making payments on it, living in a new house, making payments on it, working at the mill, just like everybody else. And then in the wintertime, if the mill shut down, the guy didn't have a job. He'd have to go on unemployment insurance. He couldn't make his payments, and he was really struggling to keep his house and keep his car. If the mill started back up in the spring, maybe he could catch up on his payments, and maybe he could keep his stuff. Like as not, he'd have to sell his car or something and then buy another car, you know, to get by with or something on that order. So I took a look at that and I said, I don't think that debt is an indication of wealth. If it is, and if America is the richest nation in the world with a $14 trillion debt, wouldn't we be twice as rich if we had a $28 trillion national debt? And if that's the standard that we want to use, shouldn't we then work as hard as possible to amass a $28 trillion debt? Shouldn't we write letters to our congressmen and senators and tell them, wait a minute, we want you to deficit finance, deficit spend, borrow more money, and accumulate a debt of $28 trillion because that's the way we imagine wealth. The more debt you have, the wealthier you are. If $28 trillion would make you twice as wealthy, Can you imagine what $56 trillion would look like on your balance sheet? I mean, you talk about dying and going to heaven. Could you imagine how things would be if you could amass $56 trillion? Let's try this one. Let's suppose $56 trillion is four times as good as 14, but can you imagine $112 trillion of debt? Because that's where Americans are today. We have $100 trillion worth of debt. If that's wealth, if this young woman's definition of the richest nation in the world is a nation of people who have an aggregate debt of $100 trillion, by golly, we've arrived, haven't we? Now, that's 300 million people, and each one of them has a $47,000 individual debt. Isn't that just special? Now, the average income of the average Joe Sixpack in the world today, well, the average in the underdeveloped world, I shouldn't say in the whole world, because out here in the West, in the United States, for instance, the average family in this country is making right at $50,000 a year. Family. Now, that's not an individual, that's family. The average individual in this country with a $14 trillion gross domestic product is making about $46,000 or $47,000 per year. And I made a misstatement here a second ago. I said that we had a $47,000 debt. No, that's our per capita income here in the United States. The per capita debt's $333,333.33. So if you've got a pen and paper, write that down, because I'm trying to figure out where the richest nation in the world is. And this young woman said that America is the richest nation in the world. She said that in 2008 while Barack Obama was running for president. So, that being the case, then, we Americans are making about $46,000 a year per capita, per person. We got a per capita, per person debt of $333,000, and we need to pay that off. Well, at some point in time. I'm not suggesting that we do it today, because that might be more than we could handle. But let's just think about it in terms of we're gonna pay off this $333,000 of debt. How long would it take us to pay off $333,000 in debt if we had a $46,000 a year income? And we wanted to pay that off over a period of years. And we have to pay our taxes, and we have to, you know, pay our mortgage and car payments and all the rest of it. Well, as we progress along here, we're going to take a look at the average Joe Sixpack's budget, and let's see how we pay this off. And I'll show you how wealthy the people in the United States are, and then you can do the same thing in your country. You can take a look at your national debt, at your per capita debt, per capita income in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Brazil, China, Japan, wherever you live in the world, and you can do the same arithmetic that I did, and you can compare your country, you can compare your families, you can compare your individual citizens in your country with the richest nation in the world. That's the United States of America. That's what this young woman said. She said America is the richest nation in the world. And I wanted to point out that America does not have the highest debt per capita either. I looked this up for you, so if you want to know where the highest per capita debt is located, it's in Monaco. Yeah, Monaco, I guess they call that. Monaco, that little enclave over in France. Listen to this. The average debt of each citizen of Monaco, or Monaco, is $500,000. $500,000, that's a half a million. Now, there's only 30,000 people that live in this entire sheikdom, kingdom, or principality. 30,000, total population. And all of them are millionaires. So, all the people of Monaco are millionaires. It's like, it would be about like Bill Gates having a $500,000 debt. You know, well, $500,000 to Bill probably is pocket change. But to the rest of us out here, you know, that's pretty good size chunk of change. Now, here in America, by comparison, we have a $333,000 debt per person. So, actually, per person, we here in the United States are wealthier than the people over there in Monaco, except the people in Monaco have assets totaling $1 million or more. They're all millionaires, and probably most of them have yachts, and most of them are, you know, in the million, 2 million, 10, 20, 30 million dollar a year range in income. And $500,000 doesn't amount to very much over there, as it would over here talking to us. We're people with jobs as carpenters, plumbers, and electricians and housewives. So there's another factor that has to come into play. We have to take a look at what we call a balance sheet. Balance sheet. So we take a look at the assets that people have, and then we take a look at the liabilities that they have, and then we subtract the liabilities from the assets, and that tells you how much wealth you've got, or how much equity. We call it equity. And most people don't own anything. They just have an equitable position. And I remember for years and years, that's what I used to have when I was a practicing communist. My banker would encourage me to work hard and save money in my bank and give him a balance sheet every 6 months so that he could keep abreast of my progress. And so I did that. And I remember one time I had assets of $500,000 and I had liabilities of $300,000, which meant that I had an equitable position on my balance sheet of $200,000. God, I was proud as a peacock. I thought, wow, boy, I've arrived. It wasn't too long after that I went broke. Then from my position of zero, I went back to work. Then I built up another balance sheet, and I had a balance sheet, and I had $500,000 on it again. And as your debts get paid off, you know, every time you make a payment on your house or a payment on your car, you get a little bit more equity build up, see, a little more equity. And then you keep making that subtraction, you know, your liabilities from your total assets. So we're trying to get total assets on here, and I did that. And your assets grow because inflation causes them to grow. You know, when you got a house that you bought for $30,000 and it goes up in value to $35,000 and you paid $5,000 on the mortgage, you got a $10,000 equitable position in the house. So you sell the house, collect your $10,000, put that down on another house. Now you got a $50,000 house with a $10,000 equity, and you do the same thing, and pretty soon, you know, you just keep doing that, and pretty soon your balance sheet continues to grow, and you really get to be, you know, wealthy. And then an economic collapse comes along. You can't make the payments on your house. You default, and they take the whole thing away from you, and all of a sudden you're back down to zero. Flat-ass broke. That ever happened to you? Happened to me 3 times. I thought I had some wealth there, but one of the things that I discovered was that a house that isn't free and clear isn't your house. A car that you don't own and have the title to isn't your car. It's only your car to drive, like a car that you rent from Hertz. As long as you keep making the rent payments, you can drive the car. And as soon as you quit making the rent payments, they take it away from you. Driving somebody else's car, like Hertz, or leasing a car and driving it around, isn't wealth. I know we Americans like to count that as wealth, but that's not real wealth. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. The richest nation in the world. That's what a young woman on the Lehrer News Hour called the United States of America during the 2008 election. She said it was the right of every American to have health care insurance. I thought it was the right of every American to drive a new Lexus, have a new car, health care insurance, a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. That's what Herbert Hoover said, chicken in every pot and a car in every garage. And let's take a look here at a wise old saying. Let me give you a wise old saying. You have never lost any money on any deal you didn't make. You've probably lost a little money on some deals that you made that you wish you hadn't. Now, I mentioned to you a little earlier here that a nation or a family or an individual who has zero debt would be wealthier than somebody, some family, or some nation that had some debt, moderate debt, or a lot of debt. And if you wanted to demonstrate that on a family level, let's suppose that you've got a credit card debt of $20,000 and you're just living it up and having a good time. May I suggest, sir, that you get another credit card and multiply your debt to $20,000? Using the theory that debt is wealth, if $10,000 in credit card debt is wealth, wouldn't $20,000 in credit card debt be twice as wealthy? You got a car with a $10,000 debt on it, wouldn't two cars with $20,000 in debt on it be twice as good? You know, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure this out. I'm not denying that the United States is in debt and working as hard as they can to develop more of it, and that Americans are working as hard as they can to bury themselves under as much debt as they possibly can service. I've been watching what's going on, but I'm asking you, is that wealth, does that make you rich? Does a nation of 300 million people with a combined debt of $100 trillion constitute the richest nation in the world? If it does, then wouldn't 300 million people with $200 trillion in debt be twice as wealthy? I would suggest that we all get busy and go out on a spending spree. Now, the second thing that I was thinking about here, that a nation or a family or an individual that was wealthy would have a positive balance of payments. Positive balance of payments. Positive means that if you spent $100 out of your budget and you bought some stuff, that you would go out and work and produce $100, which would balance that debt, balance that expenditure. So if an individual was working, let's say, at Mutual Plywood, making $1,000 a month, and he takes in $1,000 and he spends $1,000, his balance of payments then would be at zero. He isn't accumulating any debt. He's not saving any money. He's just spending everything that he makes. Let's suppose that that same guy was making $1,000 a month at Mutual Plywood. He spends $800. He has $200 left over. He sticks that in the bank. At the end of the year, he would have $2,400 in the bank, wouldn't he? He would have a positive balance of payments. Well, conversely, if that same guy was making $1,000 a month at Mutual Plywood, and let's suppose that he spent $1,200 a month, and he accumulated $200 a month in debt on his credit card, at the end of the year, he would have spent $14,200, wouldn't he? And he made 12, but he spent $2,400 more. That'd be $14,400. He spent $14,400, made 12. He'd have a negative balance of payments of $2,400, wouldn't he? All right, let's compare three people working at Mutual Plywood. All of them make the same amount of money, $1,000 a month. Worker A makes the $1,000 a month and spends $1,000 a month. Worker B makes $1,000 a month, spends $800 and saves $2. And worker C makes $1,000 a month, but he spends $1,200 a month. And at the end of the year, he owes $2,400. Of the three people, who would you pick out as the wealthiest of the three? Worker A, worker B, or worker C? Now, from my perspective in life, I would pick worker B. He has a positive balance of payments. He has no debt. And he is not living beyond his means, and he ends up the year, he's got $2,400. If we kept doing that year after year after year, 10 years down the road, worker A would be at zero. Worker B would have a positive balance of $24,000. And worker C over here would have a negative balance of $24,000. Of the three, who would you say had the greatest amount of wealth? Now, this worker C over here is probably driving a better car. He's probably living in a bigger, better house than the other two guys. And he's probably eating out more often in the restaurants. He's probably smoking more expensive cigars. I wouldn't doubt that. But does that make him wealthier? Americans drive bigger, better cars, live in bigger, better houses, and have bigger, more all-encompassing debts. And then when this game is finally played out, I think we're going to find out how much wealth we Americans have. I think it's going to be documented and demonstrated for us. I just wanted to see if we could figure this out ahead of time. Let's take a look at number three. This person, this nation, or this family would have an agricultural surplus every year. They'd have a surplus. At the end of the year, they would have consumed less, and they would have on hand more than they did the year before. Now, when we look at property as opposed to money, we count it a little bit different. For instance, we only harvest here once a year. You know, your corn, you harvest it once a year, your wheat, and so on. Well, here in the United States, we used to harvest, and we used to have such big harvests and so much surplus that we had a hard time figuring out where to put all this stuff. And in places like Kansas and Nebraska, they had to store this stuff out in the streets in big open piles, grain. And they did that, you know, for years and years. We had to build lots of silos and grain storage bins. Now, that was back in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Now that we've turned the century, we're in the 21st century, the nation, that is the United States of America, the 300 million of us now import more food than we export. Did you know that? Now, there was a time in this country when we exported more food than we imported. Now, it's just turned around. We're exporting less than we import. And then the average American, when I was a kid, had a one-year supply of food on hand just about all the time. I say the average. I don't know about you people in the city, but where I lived as a kid in a small town in Northern California, we had a pantry. And we weren't the only family with a pantry. The Mitchells and Johnsons and the O'Neills and Wagners, everybody had a pantry. And these pantries had food in them. You know, Mom used to can food. She was like a busy aunt. And then in the fall of the year, she was out busy buying stuff by the bushel and canning it and putting it in jars and putting it up on the shelf for the winter. Today, Americans live out of the supermarkets. And when I was a kid, we used to buy beans in 100-pound sacks and flour in 100-pound sacks and cornmeal in 100-pound sacks. And those sacks were in the pantry. And when we needed beans, you know, my granny would go in and she'd bring a pan of them out and she'd go through them and sort out the rocks and put a little fat back in it and boil them up and we'd have beans and cornbread. And then we had it right on hand. I mean, it was right there. We had physical possession. Today, that's really passé here in this country. The average family in this country has a three-day supply of food in the refrigerator. 3 days, that's it. If you've got a week supply of food, you're doing pretty good. If you had a 30-day supply of food, I mean, if you could stay away from the supermarket for 30 days, you'd be phenomenal. I know of a few people, but they're pretty rare, that would have a 3 or a 6 month supply of food. There's some people out there that have a year. And then I know of some people that actually have a 2, 3, 4, 5 year supply. Those are real weirdos, real crazy. I mean, somebody that would have a 4 year supply of food would be some kind of a lunatic, wouldn't it? Now, in the Bible, there are some corollaries to this. For instance, in Deuteronomy 28, and Deuteronomy 15, verse 6, there are some statements made in here that deal with wealth. And I'm going to tell you what these wealth statements are, and then I wanted to show you. From the perspective of God, the creator of the universe and the Bible, as to what he thought wealth was. I know what the Republicans and Democrats and the Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and Bank AmeriCard, I know what they call wealth. The credit card people, they say, come in and get our gold card. And one of them's got a platinum card. You got a gold card and a platinum card. Has anybody ever thought about having gold coin in physical possession? I mean, the real stuff, real gold. Has anybody ever thought of having platinum? I mean, the real stuff. Or 100-pound sacks of beans and 100-pound sacks of flour. I know it's kind of a wild idea, but it's called property. Property. And Anglo-Saxon administration is based on property rather than profit. Now, most people are interested in profit. They're not too interested in property. Listen to this story. It's kind of a neat story. It's in Deuteronomy 28. It says, "It shall come to pass, if you will hearken diligently unto the voice of the Eternal your God, to observe and do all of his commandments which I command you this day, that the Eternal your God will set you on high above all nations of the earth." So I underlined this clause that said, high above all nations, and I put two lines under the word all, because that looks like the richest nation in the world to me. I'm just reading that. Let me read it to you again. And he says, it'll come to pass if, and that's a qualifier, if you hearken diligently now unto the voice of the Eternal your God to observe and do all of his commandments which I command you this day, that the Eternal your God will set you on high above all nations on earth. Now, there's 209 nations on the planet. So if you were set on high above all nations, then you would have 208 countries below you, wouldn't you? He didn't say, I'll set you on high above some or most. It says all. Verse 2, he says, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you shall hearken unto the voice of the Eternal your God. Verse 3 says, blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your kine, and the flocks of your sheep. And blessed shall be your basket and your store. And blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. And the Eternal shall cause your enemies that rise up against you to be smitten before your face, and they shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. And the Eternal shall command the blessing upon you in the storehouses and in all that you set your hand unto, and he shall bless you in the land which the Eternal your God gives you. The Eternal shall establish you rather as a holy people unto himself, as he has sworn unto you, and that's if you keep the commandments of the Eternal your God and walk in his ways. And all the people of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Eternal, and they shall be afraid of you. And the Eternal shall make you plenteous in goods, in the fruit of your body, and in the fruit of your cattle, and in the fruit of your ground, in the land which the Eternal swore unto your fathers to give you. The Eternal shall open unto you his good treasure, the heaven to give the rain unto the land in his season, and to bless all the work of your hand, and you shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. And the Eternal shall make you the head and not the tail, and you shall be above only, and you shall not be beneath. If you shall hearken unto the commandments of the Eternal your God, which I command you this day to observe and to do them. And you shall not go aside from any of the words which I command you this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them. 14 verses, pretty straightforward. Wanted you to notice here in verse 12, he says, you shall lend unto many nations, and you shall not borrow. That's an economic treatise that we just read. You'll be blessed when you come in, blessed when you go out, blessed shall be the fruit of your body, rain in due season. I mean, those are the kinds of things there that produce a lot of wealth, produce a lot of property. Well, let's put it this way. The opposite to rain in due season would be a drought or a flood. Now, as I speak, over in Nashville, Tennessee, they just had 13 inches of rain in, I think it was 48 hours, and it flooded the city and caused several million dollars in damage. Would you call that a blessing or a curse? Out in the West, they're suffering from a 10-year drought. In California, the farmers in the Central Valley are being limited to 5% of their usual water allotments. Is 5% of the amount of water that you're entitled to in your allotment, is that more wealth or less wealth than 50% of your water allotment or 100% of your water allotment? If you were a farmer in the Central Valley of California with 500 acres and you're entitled, let's just pick up a number here, to 500 acre feet of water per year to irrigate your land, you're entitled to 12 inches of water that will cover the whole 500 acres that you own. All right, that's your allotment, that's what you're entitled to. But you can't get that because of the drought. You can only get 5% of that, or enough to irrigate 25 acres out of your 500. Do you think that would be greater wealth or lesser wealth? Now, my common sense says to me that more is better, that rain in due season, that if we had, if we don't have drought, if we don't have debt, if we're living within our means, if we produce more than we consume, if we balance our budget, that would indicate to me greater wealth than lesser wealth. Now that's the way I count it. And that's the way this guy in the Bible counts it. Now, I'm aware of how the socialists, the communists, the Republicans, and the Democrats count wealth here in the United States. They count it by debt. But I just wanted to point out to you that there's another way of counting this. And when this young woman said that she thought that every American was entitled to health care as a matter of right, I couldn't help but think, well, who's going to pay for all of this health care? See, I don't have health care insurance, and I don't want it. And I'm doing everything I can to avoid it. And I'm trying to get all you people out there, all you do-gooders, to leave me alone. Count me out. You keep all that health care for yourself. I want you to keep all that health care wealth for yourselves and leave me out of it. Would you do that? Take my share, please. And I know I'm dumb. I know I'm ill-informed. And then I know I'm dirt poor. But if you'd do that for me, I'd count that as a blessing. Because I think that I'm going to have more wealth when this is all said and done. I'm going to end up with more than you're going to end up with if you keep following after these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Well, I'm just about out of time here, boys and girls, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We'll have to take this up again next time. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc